Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2006, and today's session is entitled China, Issues of Environmental Quality and Quality in the Midst of Growth, presented by Nora Moline, number MON 2006-04. Let's listen in.
Well, we should start. The time is here. Once again, my name is Norm Moline. I teach geography at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. But I also co-direct our East Asia Overseas term. We started these in 1974. Every 3 years, we take 80 students to East Asia for a full academic term. Partly in Japan, partly in Taiwan, Hong Kong. A few times we've gone to the Philippines, but mostly a month or more in China, beginning in 1977, when even the folks in Beijing tell us we were the first academic group to be allowed into China when the doors open, which I believe, since when we're in China, they say the open door began in 1978, and I said we were here in November of 77. And so it's been a privilege. So I don't say this in a boastful sense. I've been a lucky person to be able to work with our programs, of course, building upon my own background in Chinese studies, but been able to go to China now about 30 times in 30 years. And an unbelievable amount of changes that have occurred in those 20 years, what for even the most of the most senior persons in this room would have seen in a lifetime in the United States. The changes are just astounding. Out of curiosity, how many other people here have been to China at all? Okay, good. We've got some. Approximately when were you there? Approximately what year?
I was there in the about 98 and 2002 and 2005.
Okay, that's a good spread of years. You saw a lot of change.
Yeah.
The same altogether? Okay.
Well, just last October, November.
Last October, November. That's very current. And?
Just last year.
Okay, that's good and current. Anybody else over here? When were you there? In the early 90s?
Us? No, 87, 88.
87, 88, okay.
Last year.
Last year, and we know some others. Anybody else over here? Well, it's an incredible place. We only have 1 hour to deal with a few things. Tomorrow, some things, if they're not, today we'll try to keep the focus on these topics here. In talking over with Paul Olson, the coordinator of the teaching staff this summer, we agreed, let's have a question and answer session tomorrow during coffee hour. So at 10:05 tomorrow up on the Arc. Now, if it turns out there are a lot of people there, then we'll drift down to some room where we're inside. And I said there's no presentation then. So if you have questions about other aspects of China, such as the church in China, or the population program, or anything else like that, I'll be happy to talk with you and respond to those questions. But let's save those until that time tomorrow. Today we're going to deal with two key, incredibly important phenomena for China, and that is what we in geography refer to as spatial inequalities, uneven distribution. Spatial, obviously, the spatial arrangement of this room is the way things are distributed, and that's what geography is about. But spatial inequalities means that across the space of China, we now have some incredible variances on just about every variable. And when we talk with the students in Asia or back in Rock Island, I'm glad I'm not in charge of China, because that is an incredible issue that is now in front of them. In the U.S., we have some very great spatial inequalities also, but it's not part of our official ideology to be worried about that. So we have some places in the U.S. that are desperately poor, some places in the U.S. that are incredibly rich. We don't, yeah, we're supposed to worry about it as Christians, but it's not necessarily a part of the government policy. Well, what do you do then in a socialist society which is committed to some kind of equality? And now they look at the map and this new capitalism, which has been in their hands now for 27 years, has resulted in discrepancies of wealth, discrepancies of education, discrepancies of just about everything that are as great as in the U.S. And how do they then balance philosophy with the reality? It's an incredibly tough issue. And the second one is the environment. And so even though we have only 50 minutes to cover, an hour to cover them, those are two issues which I hope when you follow issues in China, you'll find these two big things brought out even not in geography texts, even in general books about China, issues that somehow they've got to deal with. I've given you a long handout from Ted Fishman's book. This is the only one I asked the bookstore to order. I highly recommend it. It is a hardback book. But fortunately, since it's available to a kind of a popular press, it is only $26. They have about six copies in the bookstore. It's by Scribner, a more popular press rather than a university press. I highly recommend it for awakening your eyes to what's been happening in China and for clearly how the rise of the next superpower challenges America and the world. I highly recommend it. I've given you just a few handouts, a few excerpts from this, and let's see if we have any more that are still here on that one. I don't see any existing. You're using that one, right? There might be one. If you'll just turn, I'm going to use this for other purposes, but if you'll turn just to a few of the highlighted bold items on page 3, on page 3 of this, that is literally the written text, not the third sheet, but the page where at the top it says a professor of Chinese history. If you go down to the third paragraph there, at the end of that paragraph, he notes, no country has ever made a better run at climbing every step of economic development at once. I wish there were time, of course, to show a lot of slides. I didn't bring them, but in 1980, some of you may know this, he walked across the bridge, and the Americans were rare, and there was hardly a car anywhere. Buses and automobiles, and on down the line. Most people then on our early trips were comparing it to maybe what the United States would have been like, perhaps in about 1910. 1920, they did have electricity and things. That's just 25 years ago. And here we are now in which they are out-competing us in the production of some of the highest technology equipment that's out. And so no country has ever made a better run at climbing every step. He talks about this more. You can read the Fishman book on that. On the top of the next page, increasingly, the second paragraph, increasingly it is what Chinese businesses and consumers choose for themselves that determine how the American economy operates. I gave the example that this is his book in which he talks about Motorola, but even when we were there, we learned VW sells more cars now in China than they do back in Europe. And what happens in the case of Motorola, Motorola, a Chicago-based company, wanted to have cell phones, and so they got China to build the kind of cell phones that we in the U.S. want. Now it's to the point where there are more cell phone users in China, and as Motorola develops the next version of cell phones, their primary customer is going to be the domestic market in China. So when you and I go to a store, we may buy a design of a cell phone which originally, in terms of consumer research, is designed to meet the needs of what the Chinese want. They, in the same way with VW, as now VW thinks about any kind of modifications in its car, they know they're going to sell more cars in China back than in the home base. And so they're paying attention to that customer's consumer research. Now, of course, there may still be differences from what's sold in Europe, what's there. But the primary sales, more sales over there than any place. That's what we're looking at, the kind of economy. The next bold set of type down. The fact that in China, machines can be replaced by people for huge cost savings and without sacrifice in quality changes the competitive landscape of the global marketplace. And I want to assure right at the beginning, when we think of people working in China, often the American press, which tends to be, I think, very negative about China, and they don't tell sort of the rest of the story, there are certainly some places in China where the work conditions are not so good, but there are the places that I've seen, and not because tour people took us there, but because some of our students have American companies that are operating over there. Most recently was in a place in Suzhou, linked with a very fine company out of Rockford, Illinois, and Woodman, and we went to that place, or Woodward, and we went to the Woodward spot in Suzhou, and that not because the tour people wanted, again, simply because one of our students' father worked for that company. So we went to that place, and you wouldn't find a cleaner workplace anywhere. And those folks work 44 hours a week, nicely painted, well ventilated, everything else. They come, they go home on their bikes. And so when you think of workplaces in China, don't think just of sweatshops and ugly conditions. There's a wide range. It's going to depend on the company, and it's going to depend on where they are. So in this quote, when Fishman says, in China, machines can be replaced by people for huge cost savings and without sacrifice, don't think of just the bad conditions. But even there, in that place, those folks make about $1.40. About $1.25 an hour. $1.25 an hour at that factory in China. This is a good one. Well, if you're doing that at $1.25 an hour, there's no way that's going to compete with anybody in the U.S. At even a minimum wage, $5.15. And you can say, well, they have the transportation costs, but the transportation costs on these container vehicles, container vessels, ends up being just a few dollars per item. It's very, very small. A few dollars comparatively ends up being a few cents on the actual net increase in cost on an individual small item. So that's the nature a lot of this is going on. One other feature, two other points, and then we'll talk about the spatial inequalities. The notion of the China price. And I'll link that together with the China savings. If there are really, he says, two components of the China price and then the China savings, but I like to talk about the three components of the China price. On the one hand, the China price of labor, which I just gave you, in some places it's even worse, pulls down our ability to compete, because when we're paying good wages, the China cost of labor is going to pull us down. Their cost of labor is going to influence us. One of the firms in the Quad Cities, which deals with China, it's to the point now, it's a very good company, when a client comes in and says they want to buy, they're trying to get them to buy the product, one of the first questions he says the client will ask is, is any of this product made in China? And you would think, gee, this is a setup, and you better say no, this is all U.S. He says, if we say no to that, i.e. it's made all in the U.S., clients out the door, no point even talking. They have to be able to say, in his company, in his business, they have to be able to say, some part of this product is made in China. Because now the person will know, aha, that cost of labor is going to make the cost of this work acceptable to them. So the China price on labor is going to drive it down. China's ability to pay for incoming stuff, the raw materials for products, everywhere from steel to even cement to gasoline, petroleum, China can pay whatever is necessary now. They have so much money available that, in fact, some of the construction projects in Florida have been slowed down because China's buying the cement. Some of the projects in the Quad Cities are having to be put a little bit not on hold, or they're going to have to change the price because scrap steel is all being bought by China. So China can drive down the labor cost, they can drive up the input cost, and the third aspect of the China price is, because of those two, they can sell products in the U.S. cheaper than simply American-made products, and so that drives down the price of goods. And that's why it's so hard for the U.S. to deal with China. Because you don't like the first two. You don't like the fact that their wage rates are driving it down, and that the cost of the materials is driving up our construction costs, but everybody loves to go to Walmart because, boy, we can get stuff cheap there. We can get stuff cheap in Walmart because China is driving down the cost of goods in the United States. So therefore, you can imagine the incredible pressures on Congress. How can we deal with this threat of increasing competition from China, knowing, on the other hand, that you got a heck of a lot of people in the United States who like to buy one thing after another at lower prices? And if we really would somehow cut the inflow from China, which it's impossible to do, prices are going to go up, and then the people are going to squawk. How come it costs more for shirts? How come it costs more for furniture? How come it costs more for umbrellas? And on down the line. That's the dilemma of the China price, and that's why Fishman says, we got to pay attention to this place. And my own impressions from being there, which again could take a long time, are when I go to visit some of these new industrial parks outside of Shanghai or outside of Wuhan, the place where we do a lot of work with our students, or outside of Beijing or Guangzhou, and I see these modern high-tech centers, even the living quality, good housing going up, nice public parks, community centers, stadiums, factories that are huge, many lane roads wider than what we have, even in our newest subdivisions. I sometimes walk away thinking, there's no way we can compete. There's no way in the long run we're going to be able to compete with that. If there was a third party wondering, should I have the United States make this stuff in, you name our industrial park, or should we have it made in China in their industrial park? This looks pretty good to me, and I can do that cheaper there. I'm going to go there. And their quality control also has gotten better and better and better and better because they know they have to compete on the market. That's the stuff you can read more about in Fishman, the general economic growth. We indeed are dealing with an economic power already, and their goal is to be number one. They're hoping by 2100. But some are, and I'm saying economically, right? Talking military might, simply talking to be the economic power, and some of us think that it'll be sooner than that. And so particularly for the younger generation here, China will be increasingly in your life. Well, now geographers take a look at all of this. And here's where then, okay, economic growth. By the way, the latest figure that just came out, it is a record. This is July 19th of this year, just a few weeks ago. China reported its economic grew by 11.3% last quarter. The fastest pace of growth in China in about a dozen years. Well, think they've had a decade, 12 years, of mostly double-digit growth, 10 to 12%, sometimes as high as 15. A few years it's been 9. So you can imagine how that economy has grown. And now when they say in 2006 it had an 11.3% growth, it's on already a huge base in one quarter. And it goes on a lot more detail in this. But of course, they're worried about inflation. But they're just able to export and export and export and export. And the U.S. balance of payments of them keeps going up and up and up. And I think now that they have the largest amount of foreign reserves of the U.S., they buy up our savings bonds and the rest. They're just so intimately tied up in our economy. Read Fishman. The geographers look at this, and the way in which China, when they began to modernize, and look at this page called China's Models of Development. This one, China's Models of Development. I put this piece together on my own from a variety of sources so that you could have something to go. They call it the ladder step theory. And without reading all the text now in a nutshell, the ladder step theory is rather than trying to have growth occur all over the country at once, which was sort of the Maoist ideal in his egalitarian push, which had a lot of good aspects of that idea, let's have all parts of the country rise. The economic development people, beginning about 1990, said that won't work. We're going to have to allow some places to grow quickly. And then as that grows quickly, then the economic growth will back sort of down the ladder, and eventually then the other places will get the benefit. And in China, that clearly was the idea. Let's go for a Beijing. Let's go for Shanghai. Let's go down here near Hong Kong and a few other places. Let's put our thrust in those, in particular these places near the coast. Let them sell their products And let's build up their economic development, their infrastructure, and then it will trickle down. And then to go with that is also the Western idea of Western growth pole theory. The second paragraph. At a different spatial scale, Western growth pole theory has influenced Chinese urban policy. This prescribes that economic growth should emerge in selected growth poles before diffusing to the hinterland. It's very much like the latter step. And this underlies China's renewed emphasis on medium and large cities. For a while, Mao was trying to promote small-scale development. He didn't like the coastal cities because that's where the colonials had all their bad stuff. And so, okay, no more Shanghai where the Brits had been. Now let's downplay the other. Let's build up the cities that are truly China, and let's have some of the smaller cities grow as sort of an anti-colonialism thing. Well, now we've gone back to the way it was in the colonial era. Shanghai has reasons for being a good big city. It's on the coast. Guangzhou and Hong Kong, reasons. It's on the coast. Tianjin up in the north, these are on the coast. And so what they said, let's have these as the growth poles. Well, when you turn it over onto the backside, the idea was, and then I gave you one map too, just as a quick reference. The goal in this idea was that we're going to promote the eastern region as the economic growth area, and the middle will be some manufacturing, which would then go to the coast. The coast would finish the products and then sell it, so they would make the most money. The middle part might be a manufacturing sector, and the far west would be the place that provides the resources. Well, you know what's happened in the U.S. I mean, the South Dakotas and the Nebraskas and the Kansases of the United States, which provide some terrific food products, and elsewhere, they aren't exactly near the top of the economic scale. So you know what's going to happen. The western part of China generally tends not to have grown very much. The middle part kind of does okay. They're doing the grunt work of the making of steel, but the real manufacturing of the high value, the value-added products, for those of you who know that, is on the coast. What, in addition, then, the federal government, the national government did, and you can see those middle, the itemized, the ways in which the national policy of China, investment policy, give the benefit to the coasts. Foreign exchange retention policy, they put their open zones, which were initially more open to outside investment, they're all on the coast. Revenue remittance policy, some coastal provinces such as Guangdong, that's the one down by Hong Kong, some of these were allowed to remit smaller proportions of their revenue to the state as an additional incentive. Imagine how the interior provinces, they were crying, this is just unfair. But they were so busy to promote the coasts, okay, you don't have to submit as much to the national treasury, even those are the ones that really had the money to kick into the national budget. Price policy. Primary and agriculture goods were priced substantially lower than finished and industrial products. So the prices of the stuff coming from the interior, two zones, the western or the central, were intentionally suppressed while the other ones gain. So again, who's going to gain? It's going to be the coastal zone and even the very financial policy. Provinces and enterprises were given greater financial autonomy, but the degree of autonomy is not uniform. Coastal provinces and open zones enjoyed greater freedom in a bunch of these economic terms that you can see. The deck was loaded, clearly, to help the coast. And as you can see, the next paragraph, these preferential policies constituted the institutional mechanisms that have resulted in concentrated and selective growth in certain locations. The greater autonomy of the zones in matters of finance and trade supports the growth of this foreign trade. The dilemma of the interior provinces is apparent. They sell primary and agricultural goods at low prices, while they, even interior in China, who want to buy some of these products, they're paying pretty good money too, so they buy industrial goods at high prices from the coast. Coastal provinces, on the other hand, enjoy low-priced raw materials from the interior, as well as the substantial profits from selling high-priced products manufactured from these raw materials. Chinese scholars describe these results in various ways as double losses for interior provinces, unequal exchange, unequal competition, spatial inequality, we geographers would say, from east to west. Then to make things worse, as wealthy provinces reduce their revenue remittances to the state, the latter's shrinking budget, i.e. Beijing, since they're not getting as much from the wealthy coastal provinces, going into Beijing, Beijing has less money to subsidize the smaller provinces, which they said they were going to do. So most assessments of post-Mao regional policy have emphasized and predicted the widening of the development gap between the coast and the interior and between the economic belts. This gap is one of the most pressing issues in PRC. And this is not just for people talking in a geography class. Can you hold together a country in which you have the kind of discrepancies which I want you now to briefly look at? And let me, first, if you'll just take the two maps that we have that I've given you. There are a bunch of these. There's a very nice atlas of China, China Atlas. It's filled, if you ever have a chance to see this in a library, map after map after map after map. And every one of them, you pick the variable. The inequalities across the country are huge. So if you just take a look at the two that I gave you, take a look at the education map. And again, some of the color schemes don't necessarily show that much, but you will see this is the darker the color, the higher the rate of illiteracy. So you get out to places like Tibet and Qinghai, and there we have over 25% illiteracy. And yet when you move to most of the rest of the map, particularly certainly the coastal zones, and on around to this, and a few of these interior, Sichuan and Chongqing, these are very, these are good provinces in the interior, you're down at numbers which if the coloring hadn't, if the Xerox would have been able to pick it up, would be under 10%, illiteracy. China has very high literacy in places. So if you're talking about the future of kids coming out of school there, those who are in these better educated zones, they are going to be the ones to share in the growth. Is it any surprise then, just on this variable alone, and we, again, if we had a dozen other ones to them, why throughout China, even by China's admission, there are between 80 and 100 million people on the move. People who have left their original hometown villages or towns and now have moved, they aren't on the road literally now, but they've left their original base and now they live in one of the cities partially illegally, but people hire them, they get jobs and then they send some money back. But it's no wonder. If you have a chance, if you're a young person, I'm going to get over here and somehow get my way into this system because in some of these other areas it's not going to be so good. Please.
Because of the colors, I'm having trouble reading. The HUNA and Hunan province, what is their percentage of literacy?
Let's see. In Hunan province, right down here, that's going to be down. That's a good province. That's going to be down either in that 10 to 14 or below, less than 10.
Of the illiteracy
rate. Of the illiteracy rate.
How about the Hunan?
Hunan, that's also the same. That's right. Each of those. We're down at very low numbers of illiteracy rate and in all of those coastal zones. So that's one example of that. If we and we've got some data we could look at. The next side, if you look at industry, take a look at that one. In this case, the industrial enterprises. Obviously, that's what's going into the international market. Notice the amount of industrial enterprises here. Then you get a slate. Band of slightly less gray, and it decreases. All of that show, and this would be again, you would say, well, what's so different about that? That's the United States. But in the United States, we've been sort of with that a long time. I'm not necessarily saying that's good or bad, but here's a country which really was trying to somehow have the whole country be somewhat egalitarian and equal. And now we start to end up in these two variables. If you look at, wasn't there a second map? Let's see, any more of those make it around? Let's see, I have one of them to look at. Okay, if you look at this one, equality and inequality, notice what we have in this section. First, look at this one. Notice China now the rate of the least equal. China now, the United States isn't exactly a model here. We've got a lot of inequality in the United States. Notice Japan and some of the European places have less inequality than we do. If, again, if you're not sure, we're meaning all we have to do is look at the huge corporate salaries and then people who are in the lowest 15% in the U.S. Pardon?
What are you looking at?
This one here, it's a table. Did that one get, I think that one passed around.
Yeah.
Here's the table right up here that shows that. But China now, of all places, socialist China now has greater inequality between the rich and the poor than the U.S. Mao's got to be turning over in his grave. Staggering how this has occurred within 20 years. And when there are some other numbers here, the rural-urban inequality, again, that will show up. You can study this data on your own. This is just to introduce it. I hope you'll look at it carefully back in your room or when you go home. Illiteracy, again, here we have it mapped out with these X's and with these little pens and pencils. Notice when you start getting out in the West, we're getting these 20% and over amounts. If we just take, I just want to look at a couple of more variables on this, and we'll look, use that overhead. Just if you'll look at a few numbers with me. Pass this table around. As this goes around, I'll say the current, here's a couple of the current new leader of China, new for the last few years, Hu Jintao, is consciously aware of this and is trying to move more assets from the coast to the interior because he sees this is a problem. There, it's now listed in one of the books that I've looked at. My people who are really into the China scene all the time, they say it's one of the four biggest sort of issues of social unrest. This whole issue of inequality. And so Hu Jintao is trying to do that. Why I said at the beginning, I'm glad I'm not running China, and I don't think you would want to be running it either. Imagine what would happen in the U.S. if we'd say, okay, we're going to double the tax on California, Oregon, and Washington, and New York, and Illinois, and Michigan, and Texas, and we're going to send more federal money to Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Kentucky, and Tennessee. We're going to double your taxes in those countries. You folks would be up in arms. We'd say, that's not fair. I mean, we worked hard to build up our industries, our communities, our tax base here. How can you take, that's the way the coastal provinces in China think. We're the ones who are doing all this stuff, making the money out here, so how can you tax us? So the federal government's got to back off. But then the interior provinces say, yeah, but they wouldn't be making that if they weren't making that on top of the back of our backs. And so therefore, we deserve to get some kind of subsidy. So Hu Jintao says, yeah, you're right. So the pendulum swings. How are you going to satisfy them all? Good luck. I think it's going to be a huge, huge task, especially since Beijing, as you and I would probably applaud, Americans would applaud, less control by Beijing, more control given to the local communities and the local provinces. It's called devolution of power. They've released, Beijing has let out a lot of the control that used to be there. Well, now, if they've let out a lot of control, that means the individual provincial leaders and the key business people in those towns, they get to call the shots, and Beijing has much less ability to say, sorry, this is what you're going to do in the centralized economy.
Have they done the same with currency? Because when I was there in the 80s, they controlled their people because a certain province had a certain type of money. And
it's
they
all
did
the
not
same.
Go to another province.
It's all the same currency.
So now they've
yeah.
done the currency.
So here's this. Here's
it's
this.
All the same currency.
If forever, for
the
whole
nation. Same as what she described.
Yeah, it's the same currency across the nation and the same currency. It really is a national system. They used to have different money for foreigners and that's gone. Here's the same map we already looked at. We don't need to look at that one. But here, just if you look at a few pieces of data. And in this case, let's go with this one first. Again, you're not going to know all of these. I'll do this and you can put that on in a minute. When you look at these numbers, again, the point here is simply that you don't know where all these provinces are. But if we take the gross domestic product per person, something close to an average income, you can see the variation. For China, maybe slide that up just a little bit, if you would, so I can see the bottom. It's 8,000. This would be 8,000. Yuan. This is 2002 data, gross domestic product per person in yuan. the Chinese currency, which is about 8 yuan per dollar.
It was Fukui back there, you know, these days.
Yeah, okay, thank you. But if you'll see, notice there sits, and this is 2002, and that sits in the atlas. I wish we had some really great 2005 data. It's going to be more exaggerated. I promise you it's going to be more exaggerated. Here's Shanghai, and then you go, so those are way above average. Then you get down to Guangxi, Guizhou, Yunnan. I'm not even including Tibet because that's, I mean, as highlighting it, it's even better than some. And Gansu, these are provinces in the more western part of China. So you've got parts of China in which the income is for regions where, and Beijing, in this case, isn't just the city. Beijing actually includes, it's a larger area. And if you took a whole province, Liaoning, Heilongjiang, Jiangsu, Zhejiang, those are all provinces. And so they're having incomes which are two, three, or four times larger. That's the gross domestic product per person.
Historically, before Mao and before Western influence, I mean, was this a similar pattern? Were the coastal cities the rich cities and the interior was poor?
It was like that at the end of the colonial period. Mm-hmm. And then Mao tried to close down the coastal places exactly for this reason and started to emphasize development. One of the provinces we visit with students is right up here in Shanxi, where's the double? This one right here. We visit this one right now, the ancient city of Xi'an, which some of you know. Mao tried to build that up, and it's quite a modern city. But if you take the whole province, it's got an income of one-fourth of what's happening.
And before Mao?
Before, there would have been a little bit of difference way back in the imperial time.
Because I was wondering if there's a historical discontent as well.
Always a little bit between the imperial area and the other areas, and controversies between the groups. Notice the value and commodity of exports. We know that's where they're getting all the stuff that Fishman's talking about. Where is it coming from? Notice these big numbers, how scattered it is, and then look down all the rest of them, how minute some of these areas are. I circle just a couple of these with a dotted pattern just to see the great discrepancy in the value and of commodity exports. The economy is booming because of the exports. But not all provinces are sharing in it. So we're getting these huge inequalities, and they're saying, why don't you put more out in our area? At that point, economic reality takes over, as many in the room would know. Yeah, it'd be nice in the United States. Why don't we put some big manufacturing activities out at Lincoln, Nebraska, instead of down along one of the coasts? Well, now you add 1,000, 1,500 miles of transportation costs. So to talk about moving something out to some of these interior regions, Gansu province is 2,000 miles from the coast. And you'd say, well, what's the big deal? That's the way it is in the U.S. As I've said many times, it's in China that's tried not to have that happen. And on paper, it still is a socialist state. And so if people think, if you're really the leadership in Beijing, supposed to be taking care of all of us somewhat equally, why are you letting them get rich while we are still poor? That's the issue. Look at some of the other columns. Foreign direct investment. Here, this is in U.S. million dollars. U.S. million dollars. And so here, this is foreign direct money in 2002. Look, some provinces are getting a lot of U.S. and Japanese and European money. Some places are getting almost nothing as outside investment. So foreign aid is going in a very unequal distribution. The foreign exchange earnings from tourism. Tourists go over, spend a fair amount of money. Well, some places in China are doing pretty well in the dollars they're getting from tourism. But look at poor Guizhou province. They're not getting much. I've been to China a long time. The only time I saw Guizhou was when we were blocked from landing in one place by a thunderstorm, so we had to go land at the Guizhou airport. That's my experience in Guizhou province. Well, they haven't got any of my dollars. They haven't gotten a lot of other people's dollars either.
Here's a question.
Yes, please.
Oh, hi. I was wondering slightly earlier if you could comment. There was an article in The Economist in this spring that talked about the affability of the sources. Where does this information come from and how reliable are the numbers?
This comes from this book, which is, and the other, we can get it from the World Bank also. This is University of California Press.
Right. I mean,
By and large, the economic data that's coming out of China is reputable.
Okay,
so it hasn't been, I guess what I was asking about is the article commented on the ability of the Chinese government itself to sort of semi-manufacture the data before it gets to the outside world. Has that happened with these figures?
These figures are, by, again, mostly here. I worked a lot with China, but in this case, I cite more my professional geographer colleagues with very good Chinese language ability who are the researchers on China, and they say that for about the past 10 years, China's reporting of data on this kind of thing is quite accurate because they know they want money from World Bank and Asian Development Group and the rest, and therefore they got to call it straight.
Okay.
The data to watch out for China is if you see something in the Beijing Review where it says that 73% of the farmers in China are fully happy with the current policies. I mean, whatever that is. When it gets into those kind of surveys, there. But when it comes to the kind of data that's going to have to be submitted for loans, international grants, especially now under the WTO, this stuff is pretty reliable. Yeah. And especially in this case, it's even if it has been modified a little, which I don't think it has, it still has discrepancies. And when you're in China, the papers do talk about what are we going to do with this? Well, we could go on a lot. Let's see, maybe quickly put the other table on just to look at a couple of more variables that maybe flip it over. Sorry. Okay, thank you. Notice some of these are value by industry, services, and agriculture. And you know that's going to vary just in the U.S., which the state, I'll pick one, Rhode Island probably is not going to have a huge percentage of return from agriculture. So, because it's not an ag state. And Kansas may not have a lot of industrial, so you have to be a little bit careful. But when you look at some places that almost consistently are quite low, once again, Guizhou, in terms of these numbers, here's a province which is low on all of them compared to other places. They just, the absolute numbers, whereas some of these, here's this province, Guangdong. They get a lot from agriculture, they get a lot from industry, they get a lot from this. Shandong, this is a big province here. That's where, those of you who drink Chinese beer, that's where Qingdao beer is made. All right, one, two, three. They're high in all three categories. You move up, there's Jiangsu province right outside of Shanghai. When you begin to look at this, it isn't just that, well, some provinces of the country are industrial and others are agricultural. There are economic disparities, and I invite you to think about it. I want to turn a little bit to the environmental issue. We only have 5 minutes left, but this is a key one. Yes?
I don't know if this gets outside the scope of your talk, but getting back to, you're talking about internal, the focus of your talk was the internal disparities. You did mention the disparity, which to me is kind of unstable, between the fact that they're holding huge volumes of dollars.
Right, we mentioned
that. And then on the other hand, we as being expected to soak up their exports, to me there's a huge that seems to be unstable. At some point, if our ability to take their exports begins to go down for one reason or another, exchange rate instabilities, that seems to be one problem area. The other one is that China is not going to be the number one superpower by the year 2100 without all the oil that they're going to require, which puts huge amounts of the great places for where there's contests going on now are in the Stans and in the Middle East.
That's right.
And got all kinds of stuff going on there. So those are the two areas, and I'm wondering if you want to go there or...
I can go briefly. Maybe you can shut that off in the front. I think we're done with it. They feel there's an increasing middle class in China, and of course they believe that the likelihood is Americans are going to continue to want products because Walmart is there, everybody else, and the big Walmart-type firms from Europe are there. So on the one hand, they think, yeah, that maybe the imports could go down, but it's not likely because whether it's from France or Germany or the United States or Japan, people are there buying things. So it would take a huge, huge change in the world situation if all of those places stopped importing. But even if it does, the middle class now, by some estimates in China, is getting up close to 400 million out of 1.3 billion. And they sort of feel like right now, if the U.S. wouldn't buy any more cell phones, the cell phone manufacturers in China, they got enough to sell to 1.3 billion people. Just the idea of household construction. Staggering figure that even though China's population growth program is working, the average size of homes, the household, how many people living in a house, has gone from 4.5 to 3.7. And it's going to go to 2.7 by 2015. And from the time that this book was written, that Fishman was the Collapse book by Jared Diamond, but he cites the data, and that's just 2 years ago, that in the next 11 years, China is going to need 120 million new households without adding any new population, and that's more households than all of the houses in existence in the United States. In the next 10 years, China has to add, if the trend is going, that is smaller number of people living in homes, and where the son, the one child, or the if they happen to get started earlier, the two kids, they're each going to have their own apartment, just like in the U.S., instead of living with mom and dad and having grandma and grandpa there. Grandma and grandpa, now they get their little household unit, mom and dad have theirs, and the 20-year-old goes off and gets her or his own apartment. If that trend, which has now been going on since about 1995, if that keeps going, China is going to need in the next 12 years 120 million households. Think of the construction. People are going to be employed in the construction business. They're going to be buying electric appliances, electric lights. They're buying furniture. So they think that the domestic market is going to have a lot to take care of that. And then in response to the second item, they are busily making good contacts for oil. This is a good oil base. That's pretty much in their own control, although they have to negotiate that with the Koreas right off in this section. The South China Sea, all the way down to Malaysia, if we have that, is very much under debate. China claims it as their own, the way they've drawn their territorial boundary. It's amazing. If you look at a China map, it goes all the way down to 1 degree north latitude. It's a huge loop that goes, includes Taiwan, goes all the way down like this, picks up all the islands, and then loops back like that. That's what the official China map says. Philippines and Malaysia and Vietnam don't agree with that, but there are good resources out there, and they're going to, even if they don't claim it, they've got the money now, they can work out the deals. And Royal Dutch Shell, a company which is doing good things with China, fair and letting the income sort of filter down, they're part of that whole operation. And the third one is out to Kazakhstan. And we were just out here a month ago. We were right out at this spot, and at this spot, and here in Urumqi, you can see the big pipelines being constructed. And World Bank money helped China develop some good pipelines going from Urumqi down into this interior basin. They are actively finding ways to nail down their petroleum supply and continuing to get it also from the Persian Gulf area and Indonesia. So they're working on both of those. Did you have a question?
So you're going to talk about environmental issue next.
Wait, that's what we went after. We have just 10 minutes to get to that. Yeah.
You interrupted that a few minutes ago.
How is their population growth and control now? It's working quite well, and we can maybe talk about that tomorrow, but the one-child family planning program actually is working quite well. It's 1.3 billion, one child. It's 1.3 billion now, and it's probably going to level off at 1.5, and then it's going to start falling. In many parts of China, though, just to quickly answer it, now they're allowed to have two. When this was first put in, the goal was if we can get one, just one generation to have one child, we should be able to level off the curve, and it's worked, more or less. And so the current generation in many of the provinces are able to have two. And they really see it's going to level off and it's going to go back, start going back down in about 20 years. If we turn to another key issue then, and that is the environment side, I will give to you, again, something that will give a lot of the details about the environment. This comes from, normally I have some questions about Jared Diamond and his, and geographers generally do, about that book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, that some of you may have read. But the second book, Collapse, is given much better regard, and so I invite you to have a look at that one. And this last one I will give as you as we really conclude. What can we say in 10 minutes about... What can we say quickly about the environmental issues in China? There's a lot of pollution occurring. On a recently released index of nations in terms of their environmental quality, kind of an overall cumulative environmental index. Some people at Yale put it out. Number one in the world was New Zealand, and Sweden and Finland were number two and three. Malaysia was 14th, surprisingly. The United States was 28th. China is down about 90. So China has a lot of environmental problems. For now, we won't look at that handout. You can look at it later. Let me just go down a few of the quick kinds of problems, and some of the data comes from that. I'm just going to rattle off a bunch of statistics, all of which are gloomy. Air quality. In 2002, 6 of the 10 most polluted cities in the world were in China. Acid rain now impacts a third of the territory, including a third of the agricultural land. And in any of the cities in China, they estimate on one-fourth of the rainy days when you're in any of the Chinese cities, on one-fourth of those days, you're getting an acid rain impact on the city. 300,000 premature deaths per year, probably because of the polluted air. You wouldn't see these blue skies. Janet and I, we knew we'd be coming here. Not on many days you don't see blue skies like this. Because of automobile pollution, still use of coal and charcoal in some places for cooking, and in the countryside they burn off some of the fields at the end, so you got a lot of smoke coming up. It's tough to see a good blue sky day and you dream of Holden or you dream of the blue skies over Lake Michigan. Water flooding continues to be a problem in some places. Soil erosion, 20% of the land is now estimated to be undergoing some kind of erosion, in turn clogging some of the rivers. There are a number which is not in your handout, but it's really important. The cities are sprawling. If you go to virtually any city in China, and even the small cities in China are ones which are still 400,000, they have over 100 cities that are over 1 million, and all of them seem to be growing, and they are sprawling just like U.S. cities. Expressways, literally, McDonald's, Carrefour, the big firm out of France, Walmart, huge stadiums, huge parks, wide roads, everything that's just like an urban sprawl neighborhood outside of Seattle or San Diego or Chicago, you're going to see it by the Chinese cities. And if your airport lands and you go down those, you're going to think, whoa, I paid a lot of money to go to China and see this. All I had to do was go outside of LA or Seattle. That's the same kind of scene. Expressways, overpasses. In a few years, they are building their expressway network. They just started about 10 years ago, and it's almost already equal to the United States, 45,000 miles of interstate highway. They just decided, we're going to do that. And it's amazing. I go there every year, and I get back 1 year. Geez, they got another 50-mile section done. Go back the next year, and they got a whole other ring road all the way around Beijing. You go back, the stuff is going on. That's taking up a lot of farmland, and that's one of the protests. You may have read about that in the paper. They alert farmers. They're going to pay them so they don't confiscate it anymore. They alert farmers, that used to be shorter, now it's got to be 6 months. So, okay, your folks are farmers, you got 6 more months on your farmland. We'll pay you for it, but you're going to be gone then because we're putting an expressway through. And so they're finally fed up with that. They're saying, we like this, so suddenly they're having protests. But some of those people suffered, not as bad as Tiananmen, it hasn't fully come out, but some of those people may not have fared too well. I don't think they were shot, but I'm sure they were hustled off, so now people are not so sure they should continue to protest. But China is worried about that because how can you keep putting out dozens and dozens of little fires? Water scarcity. There are droughts they estimate now affect 30% of the land. The Yellow River, the second, all of us learned that in geography, huh? The famous Yellow River, it now doesn't reach the sea a certain number of days a year. It was worse. In 1997, it reached the point where 220 days out of the year, the Yellow River never reached the sea. They've corrected that. That's one of those signs of hope. They've corrected that with some good water retention systems so that now they can release water in a more controlled way throughout the full 12 months rather than watch all the floodwaters go and then be dry the rest of the year. So that is not the problem anymore, but it's still there. Water quality. Let me move through this if I can. 75% of the water flowing through cities now is estimated to be unsuitable for drinking and fishing. dwindling forest reserves, already among the lowest amount in the world. Only 16% of the land was in forestry, and the deforestation reached a point. So one sign, again, of a good news, in 1998, and it's in place now, China bans any further logging on natural forests. So they are cutting plantations, stuff that was planted were already cut. They plant those and they cut those rather than going into new forests. 1998. Now, it may not be enforced everywhere, but the sources seem to say this is doing some good. They've realized they got to save the forests. We already noted population growth. It's going to peak out a little bit. So there, we could go on, and your article tells that. There are some serious environmental problems. Then you get into the debate, though. Is economic development bad on the environment or good for it? And most of you in this room, we've given all of you know, our sort of love of wilderness, might say, well, that's a no-brainer. If you start getting industrial development, industries and all of that, that's going to hurt the environment. That's one line of thought, and there's evidence to support that, and not just there, but around the world. The more economic development that you get, you're going to have more impact on water quality, more impact on air, you're going to be cutting more trees, taking more farmland, et cetera, et cetera. But there's the other side, which, and there's some good evidence by some other scholars, that actually if you don't have economic development, if you do have economic development, you're going to start to begin to get some more cash reserves that are available for these extra things, such as a better environment. And that would be sort of the example, if you look even at the US and you look at Europe, when places finally began to be economically developed and people leading a good life, then instead of just worrying about putting bread on the table or getting a roof over their head, now they start worrying about, we want a good place for recreation. We want cleaner water. We want cleaner air. So that debate goes on, and again, I've got there some really good pages. If any of you are really interested in that, I'd be happy to Xerox them or send them to you about, I mean, two pages of carefully outlining that issue. That debate is going on in China. They are aware that the environment is having a tough time. They know it's not a good thing because they come to the U.S. Their leaders admire some of the good things that we have. They wish it were the same. They don't want their people dying prematurely. They don't want them getting respiratory diseases. They don't want to see cancer rates going up. They want this to be a good, genuinely, I mean, this isn't just cover-up. They want the place to be good for their people. So they're trying to look at the environment. But they're saying, when the U.S. says, well, you got to work at it quicker, they are aware of our history. And they remind it, we'll work that out. You didn't exactly jump quickly into environmental improvement when you were industrializing, so get off our case. So the U.S. role in sort of pushing them on that is a little bit limited. But in the last, and I'll try and do it in 2 minutes, there are some good signs. The government began to put in the 1970s and 80s, a good environmental protection administrative scheme. They adopted something like our Environmental Protection Act. They set up a legal structure for environmental improvement. They adopted more laws. It's a more codified system of laws in many ways in China, and it's called the rule of law. I'm not saying it's all perfect behind the law, but there is a law which Beijing has put in place. They have trained lawyers and judges in the environmental field. They are participating in international agreements such as the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the World Trade Organization, international NGOs. The Nature Conservancy, for example, has been involved now for 10 years, and the Chinese government really does listen to Nature Conservancy because China Nature Conservancy says we're not going to go there unless you sort of operate the way we want to operate. And the Nature Conservancy feels quite good about what they've been able to do there. Of course, the 2000 Olympics is looking over their shoulder, and by 2008, they want all taxis in Beijing to be on natural gas. Some were put in place this year, natural gas. And so to reduce that, so Beijing is probably going to look pretty good by 2008. What a person said when we were there this year, or one of the articles in one of the papers said, if 2008 is going to open Beijing to the world, forcing Beijing to clean up its act, the World Cup, which is already designated to be in China in 2018, in which case you have to have a lot of venues that are going to be used, that will be the year in which all of China will be open. And so that's kind of the target in which some people in China are saying, we're going to clean up the Beijing area as best we can by then. Give us 10 more years, and then we're going to have the rest of the country sort of up to snuff. The problems here in a minute or two, despite the infrastructure, it is weak and underfunded. There is the financial and enforcement links from Beijing and other places are pretty weak. Beijing passes the law. Some of the U.S. people don't like this either, unfunded mandates. And that's what happens. Beijing says you'll do this. The provinces say, well, how are we going to clean up the water? How are we going to do all that? You're not giving us any money. So there's a bit of a disconnect between the links between Beijing and the local places, between enforcement and the financial assistance. The biggest problem is, and then we'll probably have to stop with that, the biggest problem with this is simply unequal enforcement. And we go back now to what you and I might think is a good thing in this centralized economy, and that is to let more and more of the decision-making be done down at more local levels. Well, that's happening. Unfortunately, when it comes to environmental protection, that means in this province, and again, we could give you data on some of it, we included in the packet in that, but in some provinces, environmental protection is moving forward quite good. They're usually in provinces which have a good central leader, which is a province which is linked with the international community, where they know that there are visitors and business people coming in regularly and are going to yip if the air is bad and so on, and that there's a good structure. In those provinces, there are some good things happening. But down the road at the next province, it may be terrible because you've got some corrupt local officials who are of the old school, and even though Beijing has passed a law and they've got an infrastructure, they're just not going to enforce it, or they're going to take kickbacks from the industry. Some industry wants to be in this province because you're not going to enforce the pollution laws. Okay, give me some money, and they take the cash. And corruption is endemic in some provinces. So when you and I read the papers about what's the status of the environment in China, it's a mixed bag. But the biggest reason it's probably a mixed bag is because of this devolution of authority. It turns out that's the same thing, which we can talk about tomorrow if you wish, about the church in China. It really depends on where you are. Some places things are going fine. Some places it's just not working very well. But overall, and here I go back now to Jared Diamond's book on collapse, he looks at a bunch of societies there, and other geographers in our field would say this. There are some places where what's happening, it looks like they will collapse. But there are other places where, even if it doesn't look real good, there are some signs of hope there that people are starting to pay attention to this. What is the role of the U.S. then? We have a good environmental record, and we've got a lot of problems, but compared to a lot of places on the planet, we've got a lot to share. And therefore, we want to be involved with China, and we want to do everything we can to make sure China keeps the door open to us, which, among little things, people say, stop calling China Communist China, just call it China, and start to work with them. Sometimes we may have to turn our eyes on certain human rights violations instead of hitting them on the head on that all the time. Kind of negotiate our way through applying pressure, but making sure the door doesn't close. If the door closes on the U.S. involvement, then they say the progress in environmental improvement in China is going to be much slower than if the door is open. And so the advice to national leadership, to business people, is keep the door open. Let's keep on working on China. Let the Nature Conservancy, let the U.S. EPA, let the others continue to apply a little pressure to China and help them. This is how you can improve the air. This is how you can reduce your coal pollution. This is how you can do this. And with that, if we have that kind of cooperation with the international community to go with their own, then it may be able to, some good progress may be able to be made. And we need to do it, obviously, because the stuff that's happening in China filters our way in the air, particularly the air pollution issue. They did agree to the Kyoto Protocol, which is a good sign, and they are pushing their cars to have higher efficiency, fuel efficiency. They've got some deadlines on there that are somewhat like ours, so that there's a lot of stories out there. That's a 15-minute introduction. We got to go, but thanks for listening. I'll be happy to chat with anybody now, or we can pick it up tomorrow during coffee hour. Any questions? Okay, thank you.